Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to James A. McLaughlin, author of the novel Bearskin. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is James A. McLaughlin, author of the debut novel Bearskin. A literary thriller, Bearskin is set in the wilds of the Appalachian Mountains. Rice Moore is the caretaker of this nature preserve, a man running from a sordid past only to face a fresh crime in his new stomping grounds, black market bear poaching. With his past gaining on him, Moore goes deep into the woods in his attempt to stop the killings. James A. McLaughlin's essays and fiction have appeared in the Missouri Review, River Teeth, and elsewhere. Bearskin, his first novel, has received praise from every corner of the literary scene, including in Amazon's Best Mysteries and Thrillers of 2018 and Southern Living's Best Southern Books of the Year 2018, among other mentions. McLaughlin holds a law and MFA degree from the University of Virginia. James McLaughlin, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. Great to be here.
So, James, are you practicing law using the other side of your education when you're not writing?
It's always an interesting answer I have to give. I say I'm kind of a lawyer. I do still work with a business that a good friend and I started back in Virginia. And we work with land conservation. And he's the MFA, the former banker, and the guy on the ground. And I am one of the lawyers involved, and I just work from my basement out here in Utah and travel back to Virginia a few times a year. But he's been really good about giving me time to write. So over the past few years, I've been doing less law and more writing.
Well, this novel has had a rather long and circuitous route, has it not?
That's an understatement. It sure is. I wrote the first version back in the mid-90s. I'm giving away how old I am, when I was at the writing program at the University of Virginia. And it was a finished novel, but it wasn't very good. And I put it away. And then for maybe 10 years later, a friend suggested I come back to it. And I rewrote the first few chapters and thought, okay, well, that's good. That's done. I sent it out, picked up by the Missouri Review. And published, they called it a novella. And then after that, I had some interest from agents and editors in the rest of the book. And, you know, at that time there wasn't a rest of the book, and I resisted coming back to it. But a few years later, I started to extend it into a novel, which I thought would be, you know, I had the setting, I had the character, it would be easy. But even that took years, and I mean, the story goes on from there. But yeah, it's been a long process.
Mm-hmm. So the book is set in Appalachian Virginia. Tell us a little bit about how you managed to get there. I mean, you obviously grew up in rural Virginia, so this place must have a special place in your heart.
Yeah, exactly. I grew up, Lexington, Virginia is a small town in the mountains. And it's where my dad was a football coach back in the 60s. He died when I was young, but we lived in Lexington, and more importantly, we had my family still has this farm out in the county there, right at the base of this big mountain called Jump Mountain, and my family's run a summer camp there for decades and decades, and so I grew up spending all of my free time out in the woods from when I was a small child wandering around out there. By myself and with friends in a way that it seems people don't get to do these days. But it was pretty formative, imprinted on that landscape, and seemed natural to come back to it when I was setting this novel.
Has that landscape, the Appalachians, changed much since those days when you grew up in them?
Yes, in a couple of different ways. There are a few more houses have popped up along the roads, but in the particular area where I grew up, it's still pretty wild. And one interesting effect is the specific to Bearskin is that when I grew up, bears were these mythical creatures. You almost never saw them. You'd see some sign every now and then, and it would be a big deal for us when we were kids to find, you know, some bear poop out in the woods or a right. track or whatever. And boy, the population in the past 10, 15 years has really come back. So we see them fairly often up in the woods now. So it's the bears are thicker on the ground than they used to be.
Well, you're getting to what drew me to your book, because when I saw it, as I told you before, I was in a bookstore, and there was a staff favorite, bearskin, and I thought, gee, I wonder what that's about. And when I saw it was about bear poaching, it's like, really? I mean, I had heard a little bit about this Chinese interest in bear gallbladders, but I don't know much. So why don't you fill us in on what kind of a problem this is?
Sure, yeah. It's interesting in the way that has changed as well. It was a big deal around the mid-90s. It's funny, this whole thing started when my cousin, who lived up in that area and still does spend time there, he picked up a hitchhiker on a back road up in the mountains, this itinerant mushroom picker who had told him about these mutilated bear carcasses he's been finding out in the woods.
I know where that got inserted.
Yeah. There's some stuff in that, and actually there's a quote, what the guy tells my main character is, he don't take nothing but they hands and they galls. That's like the best line in the whole book, and I stole it from this mushroom picker.
That's great.
That my cousin related his story. But when I heard that, I'd never heard of this. It sounded very strange, and there weren't that many bears around at that time, and not as many as there are now. And so I started researching, and I found out that this guy, this mushroom picker, had stumbled on, it's kind of like the local fringe of this global black market all over the world at that time. Bears were being killed, and their gallbladders and paws were taken off, and those are sold on the black market, mostly exported to southern and eastern Asia. They're used in traditional medicine and cuisine. It's funny, bear paws are, you wouldn't think, but they're a delicacy in some cultures, and front paws are tender. More so than the back paws. I had a reading in Steamboat Springs this fall, and afterwards this guy came up and he said, I'm a bear hunter, and I take great pride in using every part of the bears that I kill, but I never knew you could eat paws. So I sent this guy off to make bear paw soup, and I don't know how it turned out. But the other thing that people are after is the bile in the gallbladders, and that's been used for a couple thousand years to treat gallstones and cirrhosis and other disorders. And there's an acid in the bile. It's called ursodeoxycholic acid. And that was chemically synthesized by the drug companies in the 1950s. And so you can buy bear-free drugs. They all seem to have the word urso in the name.
Right.
But the demand for the poaching comes more from the traditional practicers of the medical practices. And they tend to want the real thing. They don't want the synthesized stuff. And so by the late 90s, the bear species in Asia had been devastated. Weren't many of them left of the various species that are there. And somebody noticed that we have a bunch of bears in the United States, a whole bunch of American black bears. And they all have perfectly usable gallbladders and paws. And so there is this spike in demand. You have these black marketeers, they're paying, you hear various reports, but usually a few hundred bucks to a poacher for a set of paws and the gallbladder.
Wow.
And then they'd turn around and export them, and they'd make a huge profit, tenfold, hundredfold, depends. Those are drug-like profit margins. And so one thing I found in my research back then was that organized crime had moved into this bear parts market, and that struck me as a really great background for a novel.
Does this still go on today?
It does. You still hear reports. What's happened, I think, in the United States is several different factors have caused a decline in the poaching. You still hear about it, but it's not as big a deal. One thing is the bear hunters kind of got organized, you know, the real bear hunters,
right,
the ethical ones, and kind of put the kibosh on it, just culturally, and also through law enforcement had an effect. But another kind of interesting, terrible thing that's happened is in Asia, China, Vietnam, Korea, that somebody figured out that you could farm bears. You could get wild bears, catch them as cubs, catch them as adults, stick them in these cages, and it's this horrific practice where they basically milk the bile from these live bears, and so that created a flood of bear bile on the market.
Yeah.
And it's so bad. There's so much of it in some parts of the world that they come up with new uses. They put it in shampoo and toothpaste, crazy stuff like that. Mm. But then you still have the traditionalists who they don't want that domesticated farm-raised bile. They want the wild bile, and so there is still demand for paws and bile. It hits Russia pretty hard. the Russian bears apparently are getting hit. Mm-hmm. And you do still see it here and in Canada.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is James A. McLaughlin, author of the novel Bearskin. You refer in your novel to the bear culture and at one point refer to complex social networks. what's that all about?
Yeah, I read some. Of course, I did a ton of research here,
right.
And I've had some bear people scoff at my assertion there, but also some other bear researchers. They say that in an old place where the population has not been disturbed for multiple generations, like the big old growth forest that I make up for my book, that you can have this. They're not particularly social animals, but they are smart and they do interact with each other, and their ranges will overlap, and they will have relationships that develop. They can be long lived in the wild in this sort of situation, and you can have a kind of bear culture. Now, you'll have callers, bear biologists calling in, arguing with that. But I like to imagine that that's true.
Well, I'm on your side on that one, so we'll let them call in. So let's talk about Rice Moore, your protagonist, the main character of the book. He's a bit of a study in contradictions. He's taking care of this preserve, basically decides he's going to get these bear poachers. But tell us about the rest of Rice Moore. He's a complicated guy.
He is. He is funny. When I first wrote the book, a lot of people's first novels, the protagonist is disturbingly close to the author, and that was one problem with my first book. And when I tossed that clown out, I was casting about for who am I going to replace him with, and I'm imagining this scene in the beginning where Rice is working on the cabin, and he walks outside, and he's startled into this strong fight or flight response by the shadow of a vulture, and I've had that happen to me, though I don't react as strongly, and so I wondered, and so I imagined his reaction, and I thought, well, why is he so jumpy? And so that led to a lot of work over a long period of time to figure out who he was. But he has this background. He comes from Arizona, grew up in the Southwest. He's trained as a biologist, just as a field scientist. He's not a PhD or anything. But he had fallen into smuggling, but back and forth across the border, kind of a boutique smuggling operation, with a woman that he fell in love with. And that went very, very, very wrong and led to him doing some pretty violent things. And he also ran afoul of some really, really scary people. And so he kind of engineered his own witsack, his own disappearance, and ended up at this preserve back east in Virginia, hiding out. He takes an assumed name, and I did some research on how you can disappear. And my wife saw that book on my shelf, and she asked me about it.
Yeah, right.
So he does some of these things you can do to cover your tracks and disappear. And so he's hiding out as the caretaker of this nature preserve. Mm-hmm. And but his past does catch up with him.
Well, it's interesting that you cast Rice Moore as a biologist, because that gave you, the author, the license to spend a lot of time talking in this book about the animal kingdom, about man versus nature. My gosh, the salamanders, the skunks, the snakes, the bears, the chickadees. I want to give a shout out to the chickadees. You gave a shout out to the chickadees. That's my favorite little bird. I know I can hear a chickadee miles away, it seems. It's the only real bird song I remember. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, did you go into this novel knowing that, I mean, you do such a beautiful job of describing Appalachia and the forest. That had to be part of the reason to write this book, the way you've interspersed so often these great scenes.
Yeah, it's kind of where I come from. I don't have any formal scientific training, but that is, you know, it wasn't something I planned to put in the book, but it's so much a part of me that it definitely became the place, the setting, the ecological setting there is kind of a character in the book. And so you put your finger on something important, that casting Rice as having some scientific training and having a scientific bent allowed me to get away with with some range in the book, ranging from, you know, his scientific exploration of the place to his this trauma in his past and these terrible acts that he's committed. And because it's a close third person, I kind of needed the character to be able to span that range himself plausibly. And so, yeah, I hit upon that idea of having some scientific training. Nobody else has commented on that particularly. That's really interesting.
Well, this book has been called a thriller, and for good reason, because the last one-third of the book is something you don't want to put down until it's over. And I just say that to remind our listeners that this is a great read in so many ways, including, I might add, giving me a new term I had never heard before and know nothing about, the ghillie suit. You might help us understand how this, I think, goes all the way back to Scotland, but more importantly, what role it plays in the book for good old Rice, who's trying to track down these bear poachers.
Sure. Yeah, the ghillie suit. I knew about the ghillie suit. I've tried to make one not as much success as Rice had. They're used by snipers now. You would see them in movies about snipers, SEAL team snipers and Marine snipers. They'll crawl around in these ghillie suits. They're these big, shaggy things that you usually make yourself. You can buy them, of course, on the internet, but the real aficionados make them, and they completely break up your outline. And they're not like a camouflage jacket. They completely destroy any sort of human outline, and they also, you're supposed to make them stink. They came from, as you said, Scotland. These sheep herders were using them to hide and to catch the people that were attacking their sheep. And pretty quickly, these folks got hired on by the owners of the big estates to be their rangers. And so they would, you can imagine if you're a poacher coming onto some Scottish estate and you have some clown jumping out of the bushes from complete invisibility in this furry suit that doesn't even look human, I imagine it'd be pretty effective. But for Rice, he hit upon this idea that maybe he'd been trying to catch the poachers, but without success, and he thought he might need some better camouflage. So he did make this suit. And it did help him with camouflage, but it also had these other effects where it changed the way he and the forest related to each other. And he did one of these things where you put on a skin and you kind of turn into that animal. And he puts on this ghillie suit and he goes a little farther into the going native process. It was an interesting psychological journey to explore.
You also have quite a bit in here about guns, and you name a few varieties and sound very, very, very well read when it comes to guns. Is that from a personal experience? In fact, I want to read a line that I'm curious about. You're describing Rice. He enjoyed shooting, but he'd never been a full-on gun nut, and he was at least ambivalent about the wisdom of stirring a bunch of highly lethal weapons technology into the soup of everyday human society. I mean, it's hard not to read that without thinking about some of these gun nuts that are going off in schools and shopping centers and whatever. I mean, I don't know whether you were going that far with that line, but that's what I got out of it.
When I was a kid, I was a gun nut. I grew up hunting and fishing on this property that I mentioned earlier. That was those were my primary obsessions for years, and I could talk about ballistic coefficient and overbore capacity. I've forgotten what they mean, but I used to be real, real smartass about knowing what the guns were about. So I did. I had some background. I have a lot of experience with guns, not as any sort of professional law enforcement or military experience, but just I'd spent a lot of time with them, and it was a point of pride because it does annoy me when writers get gun stuff wrong. And I've a couple of people have contacted me. Apparently, gun people who said, "You got the gun stuff right," which I was going, "Phew,
Yeah,
was,
right.
It means a lot to me. Right. But in terms of that quote that you pulled, that was just me trying to imagine how Rice would think about this, because the being armed is important to him given his former occupation. And he kind of grew up with guns too. But he also has this notion of seeing it as a technological issue, that there's this lethal technology that is stirred into the soup of society. And he's at least ambivalent about that.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with James A. McLaughlin, author of the novel Bearskin. The novel is a literary thriller about bear poaching in Appalachia. So Rice has a little bit of help in this novel. The previous caretaker, could you just tell us a little bit about her and the role she plays in your book?
Sure. Yeah, she's Sarah Berkland. She was the caretaker on this preserve immediately prior to Rice's tenure. And she's a real scientist. She's a postdoc. She's a herpetologist. And she was studying some of the species on the property. She had a particular fondness for this particular kind of lizard. But she was also what one of the characters, or actually it's Rice. Rice sort of offhandedly calls her a tree hugger. She was pretty outspoken about her views and became a public figure. And she also made a point of running off the bear hunters that she caught on the property, as she was supposed to. That was part of her job. But this got her into some trouble with the locals. And she had a pretty terrible, violent experience. And that ultimately led to her having to step aside as the caretaker, which opened it up for Rice to come in. She's very involved with the property still, and is friends with one of the people who represent the owners. It's a charitable foundation that owns the property. And so Sarah comes in to Rice's life pretty early in the book and becomes pretty important. Reveal whether there's any romance or anything, but they do partner up and learn from each other, and it becomes a pretty intense relationship.
By the end of the novel, was it intense?
I'd say it's an intense relationship. I did resist doing things with that relationship that I felt would have been predictable.
Exactly.
That's
exactly why I asked you that question, because I have to admit there must be a little bit of the romantic in me, because I kept waiting and waiting. But anyway, we'll let the listeners figure that one out.
Okay.
That's great. I love it. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the contrast between where you live now and where you lived in Virginia. And I got a kick out of the fact that you helped. I had a home in the Appalachians in North Carolina, Western Mountains in North Carolina.
Oh, nice.
And I lived in Kentucky as well. In fact, I lived in Eastern Kentucky, where hollers were hollers and they weren't canyons. And,
sure,
and
right.
I think you had, might have been Rice, point out to somebody that, hey, look, in the West, they're canyons. In the Appalachians, they're hollers.
Yes.
How do you handle this, living in both of these places you must love?
I do. I love both of them. We live back out east of Salt Lake, up in a canyon in the Wasatch Mountains, and I do love it here. I've always wanted to live out west, but of course my home, and like I said, the place I imprinted is the mountains of Virginia, and I found it was surprisingly helpful to be this far away. I go back a lot. My family still owns the farm, and my mom just died a couple of years ago at the age of 97. So my wife and I would go back and spend time with her pretty often, long stretches of time at the farm when we could do that. But being away, being this far away, made me, instead of being able to walk out the door and get something, I would reach back into my childhood impressions for things. And everything's bigger and kind of mythic in your childhood impressions of a place that you experienced very intensely for a long period of time. And so I thought it was good for fiction to have a mythic, somewhat more mystical, childlike experience to draw on. And of course, when I needed something, you know, a hard fact, I would go look for it. I have good friends there who know a lot about the area, and I would go there myself, so I could fill those blanks. But the basic kind of fundamental foundation of the place, of the book, was this sort of mythic, childlike impression of a place, and that may make it somewhat less realistic, but for me, it made it more fulfilling.
Well, it was beautifully done, and I think it's the reason why you're getting such great reviews from folks who've read it. There's another place in your book, Arizona, Mexico, the border, that plays into this novel, because, of course, that's where Rice got into trouble. Do you have personal experience there, or did you just have to find some place to make this work for this guy?
Some experience there, because one of my cousins, he's a musician in Tucson, Peter McLaughlin, good friend of mine. I started visiting him in Tucson in the mid-80s, and he's a big outdoorsman, and we would go and explore that border country and the Sky Island country south of Tucson and east of Tucson. It's this magnificent place, and it really struck me. It was my first in-depth experience of the West coming from back east, and that Sonoran Desert is surreal. And for somebody coming from the Appalachians, it really stuck with me. And I've continued to go down there most years for a visit. And especially when I came up with the idea of Rice, and he had this past in that area, it gave me a good excuse to go visit my cousin and explore that country. So yeah, I have not an expert on that area by any stretch, but I have a great love for it.
Well, I think I have time for one more question, and this is going to sound like it comes from a professor of creative writing, but believe me, I am far from a professor of creative writing. But I was really impressed with the way you decided to handle these two major narratives. There's the Rice-Moore narrative as a mule in Mexico and the problems he gets into, and then there's the Rice-Moore as the caretaker in a preserve in Appalachian Virginia. And instead of... And I think what you could have done is that you could have started at the beginning of Rice Moore's problems in Arizona and told his Arizona story, and then all of a sudden he escapes to Virginia, and it's one streaming narrative. But instead, you chose to take the Rice Moore as caretaker preserve narrative and then intersperse the novel with the background and the history of what Rice Moore did back in the day when he was a mule. And I'm curious, not being a student of creative writing, how you come to a decision like that?
That's a great question. The primary narrative was always in Virginia. And when I came up with the Rice character and imagined his past, I did think about maybe just kind of starting with the drama that occurred in the border country. But it would have thrown off the balance, and I wanted the main storyline to be occurring in Virginia, and deciding it was kind of funny over this long writing and revision process that backstory came out and went back in and came out and went back in, and so it was never it took a while to gel, but I felt it worked better this way because Rice's history and his past and what he's done in the past informs who he is now. And it just felt more smoother and more interesting to set off instead of have him. Yeah. And I remember that time on the border, you can do it that way too.
Right. Right.
But I felt like it just worked a lot better having these separate kind of, instead of having a flashback, just have a chapter that occurs in the past relative to the current narrative. Yeah. Gosh, I bet that a smart MFA person could give you a really technical explanation for that and why it works. But for me, it just felt like it worked right.
Well, it works for the reader because the reader, doesn't get everything about Rice Moore in the first chapter. And and there's new discoveries throughout the novel that make it more interesting, in addition to the fact that this is still a thriller because you're really trying to figure out what is going to happen to this guy, Rice Moore. Anyway, we've run out of time. James, I have to tell you, this has really been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed reading the book. I encourage our listeners to get out and get a copy of it. It's called Bearskin, and it's by James A. McLaughlin. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with James A. McLaughlin. Next week, Idaho State Representative Melissa Wintrow will join me as we discuss No Visible Bruises, one of the New York Times 10 best books of 2019, with author Rachel Louise Snyder. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. Thank you.